You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 13th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 336 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marco Sippi.
On today's show, we'll be welcoming back one of our favourite polymaths to the show, Simon Garfield, whose wry observations on topography, map-making and now diary-keeping keep us coming back for more. He'll be telling us why he's edited down over a million words and 60 years of memories from the life of one woman, Jean Lucy Pratt.
Then we'll be hearing from the reporter Tim Judah, whose time spent amid the conflict in Ukraine has led to both illuminating and poignant tales in his new book, In Wartime, Stories from Ukraine.
And finally, Tom and I will be cozying up together under a blanket by a log fire in the company of Lars Mytting, the Norwegian journalist and writer whose book, Ruminating on the Simple Nordic Pleasures of Chopping, Stacking and Burning Wood, has turned into a global publishing and TV phenomenon.
My cockles are feeling warmer already, Marcus. That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be attempting to pin down next week's biggest stories that haven't hit the headlines yet. In the news, look ahead, and Marcus will enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Marcus, what a week it was, and what a week it promises to be. We're ticking towards... well, I guess the end of the year here at Midori House, aren't we? It's a busy time, certainly in Radioland.
Exactly. We're going to have a special holiday programming on Monocle 24, which means that we've been quite busy over here putting up special shows and planning the holiday season. And, well, when we are not at Midori House, I think quite a few members of staff have been running around trying to find some gifts as well for
the holidays. They have indeed. Yeah. Tell me, Marcus, I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but what is the sort of Christmas time, the holiday season? What does it mean to you?
What does it mean for me? That's a very deep question. I guess
it
it's all about...
profound. I deal only with profound questions.
I guess Christmas for me is about seeing my family, going to Finland for a few days and kind of realising that actually I miss London already when I'm there in the countryside, watching my father watch Police Academy 4 again.
That's now, we're going to be talking about... I'm looking forward to hearing from Lars Mytting a little later.
Lars Mytting is great. He's
talking about stacking, chopping wood.
He's kind of from my neck off of the woods and... His book has been a massive success around the Nordic region. It's been released in all of them, all the Nordic countries actually, and the Finnish version had a special section kind of dedicated for the Finnish climate, Finnish saunas.
Exactly.
And
well, we'll probably touch on this later.
There are good piece of advice on how to heat your sauna in Finland as well.
How, as a Finn, how would you stack your wood up?
Oh, I'm useless. I'm useless in that business. I haven't actually made up my mind. I've never even thought about that topic. I only realized when I was looking at that book, reading it through, that there are quite a few things to actually consider when you are dealing with wood and chopping wood and drying wood. I've done all that stuff. I've just never done the brain work, it seems.
Not for the first time. Well, we'll ask Lars about that a bit later. I tell you who I'm looking forward to hearing from.
Simon Garfield.
Oh, of course, yes.
I know. You are from London. You like history, so you will love this new book. It's called A Notable Woman. It's the romantic journals of Jean Lucy Pratt. When I first saw this cover, I actually thought that you would really, really like it, because I know you love romantic comedies.
I'm a romantic,
Tom, so
heart.
This is really your stuff.
I tell you what, though, before we hear from Simon and talk about A Notable Woman, should we hear from... a notable man?
Which one? Are you referring to
Henry Rhys Sheridan?
Yes, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, blow the way Texas hop.
But how am I doing now?
All right.
How am I doing now?
Everything's all right, Marcus, because Henry's here in Studio One.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
What gems do you have for us, Henry? Next week's news today, where do we start?
News One, today, Sunday the 13th of December, Italy is hosting an international meeting to promote a political deal between rival governments in Libya. I think this is very interesting.
Tell us more.
International concern is mounting at the growing strength of ISIS in the North African country.
Mm-hmm.
the UN-mediated peace talks between the internationally recognised Libyan government, which is in the eastern city of Tobruk, and the parliament in Tripoli, the capital, have seemed fairly close to delivering an agreement for months, and yet have always fallen short.
What do you think will happen next?
Well, the UN is pushing strongly for a resolution. I mean, it's quite stunning, I think, that we're talking about ISIS now getting a foothold. It's 600 kilometres across the Mediterranean from Sicily, which obviously is, you know, Italian territory proper. And the situation there just seems to be getting worse. And I also find it interesting that Italy is taking it upon themselves to host this, not only because of its geographical proximity, but also because of the colonial history.
Of course. And,
you know, the kind of the way in which all the kind of former big colonial powers of the Middle East are now the main orchestrators of the solutions.
Well, that is undoubtedly going to be a busy meeting today indeed. What else is on your news radar at the moment, Henry?
Number two. Wednesday, the 16th of December, in Omaha, Warren Buffett is meeting with Hillary Clinton. It's Warren Buffett's hometown. Why? To try to catalyse enthusiasm among grassroots Democrats over there. They agree on a lot, Buffett and Clinton. Mm-hmm. Buffett advocates a Buffett rule, a progressive taxation rate.
It's a shame it's not a buffet rule.
Well, now.
Maybe it is.
I was going to come on to this because I've printed off.
Tell me there's a Buffett buffet.
Did you print an invitation?
I printed off an invitation. Contribution levels. Okay. It's a subheader.
How much?
For $500, you can be a friend. No description of what service you get.
Presumably
a friend. That's what it's called.
It's quite a promise, actually. A friend of Hillary's.
Wait for it. Wait till
you
hear the superior categories. £1,000, you can be a supporter, which includes a photo reception with Warren Buffett. For $2,700, for $2,700, you can be what they refer to as a champion, which includes a photo reception with Warren Buffett and HRC herself. If you raise $27,000...
That's a sudden big jump.
Mm-hmm. You become what they refer to as an event host, which includes a host reception with Warren Buffett and Notorious HRC and membership of something called the Hillstarter Program. I'm not sure what that entails. I hope it involves canapés, though. I would expect that
definitely
the reception...
You've got to get canapés for $27,000.
I mean, if you paid $27,000 and there wasn't a canapé, what would your reaction be?
I don't know, but I'd also anticipate a drink with an umbrella, one of those little umbrellas in it.
Any other garnishes in the drinks, Marcus, that you enjoy?
Gin tonic always
gin
good.
Gin tonic, just lemon, no umbrella.
Marcus just wants
I like
good.
Things.
Just want,
I like things quite simple.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
They're
yeah.
amazing. I find these kind of political hierarchies are fascinating.
You didn't answer
my direct question.
Go on.
Does a Buffett buffet happen?
I don't know. I offered you alternative information that I thought pertained to your concerns.
Okay, it's in the ballpark.
And what do Hillary's friends actually get? I don't think. Do they get a phone number?
I would have thought that would be considerably more valuable than even the most delicious of canapés.
Sure, she'd give you her email address. Everyone's read those.
it's
Hillary@yahoo.com.
I mean, it is stunning, these kinds of fundraising events. There's going to be one later in New York. Same deal, Hillary Clinton. The tickets are starting at $33,400.
So head for Nebraska, that's what you're telling me.
That's what I'm telling you. Get in early.
Bargain.
But it is interesting the way campaign financing works in America and the fact that there are so many constraints on the amount that you can donate straight away.
Interesting
is
a polite word
for
how it works.
Sure, sure. Keep your eye on
intriguing.
Electoral Canada.
I like the fact that Warren Buffett still lives in his same old house that he's lived in Omaha.
Does he?
Hence he's known as the Sage of Omaha.
Really?
Yeah, he still lives in the same
Didn't
house.
Know
same
that.
Modest house as he's lived for whatever it is, 50, 60 years.
Remarkable. Mm. Remarkable man. Shall I move on?
Let's move on.
What's
I think
next?
That came to a natural end. Number three. It's happening on Thursday, the 17th of December. Vladimir Putin, that's his name, is set to give his annual nude marathon.
Oh, this is always entertaining.
In Moscow.
Yeah. How many hours is he going to try and get to this year? What was last year's one?
I've got some stats.
Great.
I think they began in 2003. 2008, longest one yet. 4 hours, 40 minutes.
440.
A lot to talk about.
That's long.
Do we have a good idea of what the topic list is going to be like this year?
Mainly focusing on Vladimir Putin, I'm guessing.
I could imagine there could be something about Turkey as well. President Putin is thinking about Turkey at the moment.
I think that might get a mention.
Let's face it, he's always busy. But what is interesting is that last year he was very much, his role was quite straightforwardly the bête noire of kind of Eurasia and Europe. Everyone disliked him, Ukraine, you know, the ruble was down. Now, He's been brought back into the fold diplomatically.
Some kind of diplomatic rehabilitation has been occurring.
Definitely.
Does he get shirtless during this?
Excuse me?
Shirtless.
I mean, I don't know. He hasn't in previous years, to wit. He might. I don't want to say he won't.
Because he's full
because
of surprises.
If he does,
is he going to be in one of those miniature submarines?
Is he going to be in a miniature submarine?
He's done that before.
Again, I don't know. I don't know, Tom.
I feel like you don't have the details.
I don't know what he's going to do.
Henry, when you've been, you know, you're quite sporty and you like to do stuff. When you ever look at what Putin has been doing, do you ever feel like you'd like to try some of the same things? You know,
like
go
bear
hunting with no shirt on.
I'm a vegetarian, so I would leave. I would let the bear. It would be a catch and release. If I were to go bear hunting, I would operate according to catch and release. So I might trap it in a net. Suspended between two trees, such that when the when it steps on a trigger, a hairline trigger, it gets sucked up and it's like in the.
But I feel like the look ahead has taken a strange turn.
That would be an amazing show. It kind of goes into circus category, doesn't it?
Bear hunting with Henry Sheridan and Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, no,
there would be a lot
of
middle-aged women over there if you both guys promised to be with no shirts on.
Do you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think that's my demographic
target? I'm just actually hearing from our producers that there would be no demand for that show whatsoever. So let's move on.
That was Henry Rees-Sheridan with this upcoming week's news. Thank you very much. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Simon Garfield is a polymath who can turn his writerly talents to seemingly any subject and come back with something that nobody's said before. We've welcomed him onto Monocle 24 in the past to talk about typography and map making, amongst other things, with his books Just My Type and On the Map. And now we have him back to discuss an altogether more personal topic, diary keeping. It's the journals of one person in particular that has captivated Simon, Jean Lucy Pratt, a British bookseller who kept diaries from the age of 15 back in 1925 and continued right through to her death in 1986.
Jean left the world over a million words contained in 45 exercise books, and amid those personal memories she built a vivid documentation of both her own life and, less directly, a sharply observed history of some of the major events of the 20th century. Simon Garfield has sensitively collected some of these memories in A Notable Woman, the romantic journals of Jean Lucy Pratt, and he joins us now to tell us why hers was a life we might all want to know a little more about. Simon, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Could you start by giving us a bit of background? How did you come across these diary books, 45 of them?
Yeah, a long story. There were 45 journals and then a huge amount of loose leaf journals as well. So it began 12 years ago or so, where I was in an archive called the Mass Observation Archive, which is this wonderful collection of life writing at the University of Sussex that began in the late 30s. And the founders said, we don't really know. This was before focus groups and Gallup polls and, you know, vox pops on the news and everything. We don't really know what anyone who isn't famous or powerful thinks about important issues. So they asked them about, you know, initially the abdication crisis and then obviously the build-up to the Second World War. And then during the Second World War, they said, please keep diaries, send them in. We're not going to send you questionnaires. Just tell us about your lives during this huge conflict, you know, the biggest challenge to the participants. And one of the journals was kept by a woman called Jean Lucy Pratt, although initially we weren't allowed to use her real name. And I edited her diary just during the war and after the war with a few others, put them together in a book, and that was very nice. That came out, it did quite well. Then her niece got in touch and said, did you know that Jean not only kept diaries during the war and afterwards, but actually her whole life? As you said, you know, from when she was a 15-year-old girl to when she died, when she was 75. And I was down, I think they were in Taunton in Somerset, and I was down there within an hour, but it may have been a day or two. And I was reading these things, and she got them down from the attic, classically in a big suitcase, and I was reading these journals. And they were the most personal, sort of heart-rending things about, you know, her sort of lost loves and the crushes she had on boys and girls at school. And then it went on her whole life. And you say, a bookseller, and lived in Wembley and Burnham Beaches in Buckinghamshire. So anyway, so I got very, very involved in this, just reading them there on the kitchen table. But it's taken me 10 or 11 years to actually get them into print, because the owner, her niece, was slightly reluctant and then said, go on then. And then she said, no, maybe not. And then finally, 2 years ago, she said, OK, I think the time is right now. And we're all getting on a bit. And she always wanted to be published, so off you go.
And was her reticence, do you think, to do with this, one of these things that, it's one of the things that makes life writing so compelling, and that is that frankness, the openness, the honesty, the revelatory quality. Is that what her niece was wary about? Because they're extraordinarily personal.
They are very frank.
For fear of stating the obvious.
Yeah, no, they are very frank. I thought initially, well, there must be some terrible skeleton in the cupboard. You know, someone must have got murdered or defrauded along the line or something. But actually, that didn't happen. And I don't think this is why she was reluctant, really. I think there were two things. One is that her niece, whose name is Babs, a lovely woman now in her 80s, doesn't come out of the diaries too well initially. not because she did anything terrible, but because she was just a very troublesome teenager. And she went to stay with Jean, the writer. And she clearly, you know, she didn't help with the washing up and she didn't do her room and she didn't really care about anything but herself, as one doesn't when one's a teen, really. So there was a bit of that. But then I think she felt that actually she was protecting Jean, you know, by sort of withholding them, because they are fantastically, frank and personal. But it was also very clear, initially, a first page of the journal, she says, these aren't to be read until after my death and they're top secret and everything. But as the diaries go on, she then addresses the reader in a very spooky way and says, dear reader, if you're reading these journals in 50 years' time, as I was, of course, please do not think ill of me when I say, you know, X, Y, Z. So it is very clear, reading the diaries, that she did want them published, you know, after her death.
It's so easy to think that we have quite a good understanding of what life was on the 20th century, but when you were going through those exercise books, can you give us examples? What were the things you learned or realised about that period of time?
Well, one is how things really haven't changed at all. You know, the basic human emotions of, you know, what is life all about? This sort of, you go on a personal quest and think, you know, am I wasting my time on earth here? You know, why are we all here? And also, what contribution, you know, can I make? She felt that, absolutely, through the 30s, 40s, you know, and 50s especially. And she was trying to find her way. The way we feel when we fall in love and things don't work out hasn't really changed, you know. It probably doesn't change from the ancient Greeks, but, you know, you get that very personal view. And then you get the real insights that she would have been reluctant to have written about in public, or you know, she probably wouldn't have written about it in a blog, or had she known her journals would be read at the time. For instance, so I mentioned these earlier diaries that she kept for the Mass Observation Archive. So in there, she wrote about VE Day. So, you know, 1945, everyone's on the streets, the war is over, what a wonderful thing, and we have this picture in our mind, Trafalgar Square, everyone kissing each other. She wrote pretty much that, and then she goes home and writes in her personal journals, I'm so lonely, it was terrible, I had no one to go to the parties with in Trafalgar Square, and here I am all on my own writing this journal, and what a sad life I lead. You know, it's sort of that kind of personal sort of insight that you get with the big public events that I think makes it so interesting.
Jean kept diary for about 60 years, and that's a lot of text. And now the result we have over here, the one version you have edited, has got slightly over 700 pages.
Yeah.
What about your principles? What to include and what to leave out? And what did you leave out in the end?
Okay, so I think the total was, I actually underestimated, I think, when I wrote the introduction. I think it was probably 1.5 million words. And I edited it down to about 250,000. So as you say, it's still 700 pages. Had I not edited them at all, you would have got 3,000 or 4,000 pages. And a lot of it is inevitably repetitive. And a lot of it is very obsessive about a particular thing that, you know, no one would be interested in now. I had to really edit it, I suppose, 2 or 3 times, because, you know, I was very conscious that I wanted people to read it now and be interested. So you're looking for narratives that will work over a number and will become a page turner in the same way. So often you would go off, I would go off on angles thinking, OK, so she's written about this bloke and she meets him and then it goes on. Is this going to be anything? No, it's not. And because it isn't, then you have to say, OK, well, I'm not going to include that. And only the ones that where relationships last or have a certain sort of weight to them, you then include. And the same when she was going off on, you know, I talk about her spiritual quest quite a lot. She talks about it, and I think this is very important. And she sees an analyst, a very early sort of psychoanalyst, you know, who tries to talk her through kind of slightly difficult periods in her life. And some of those are really fascinating, and some are just so involved. It couldn't possibly have included. It would have been like being in the analyst session, and would have been, you know, would have been kind of way too heavy and way too dense. So you sort of have to. I am inevitably looking at it from a modern eye. And if someone else would have, or someone else now wants to come in and edit it, you know, good luck to them because it's a serious job. But they would have picked, I think, maybe 3/4 of the same things, because they are, you know, clearly sort of the inciting moments in her life when she gets a new job or this happens or some terrible event or some fantastic thing. And then I think someone else would have picked another quarter. So, you know, it's quite a personal
selection.
What's the
writer? I mean, we mentioned in your introduction about your sort of writerly flexibility, all these different projects that you've worked on. Did you come at this as an editor? Do you have to channel your own inner diarist or journal keeper? Is it as a social historian?
I used to do a bit of editing, but before I was a writer, and I've edited, I think, 4 books now. And you look at it very much, you have to say, what will the reader find interesting in this? You know, what do I find interesting, and what will a reader find interesting? But I was also aware of other issues, such as, you know, you want to paint her in a generally good light, because you want to keep that sort of, you know, fortunately, she was a good person. Had I found some terrible skeleton, then I would have paid.
I was just going to ask about that, because through going through all her exercise books, all her diaries, you've been spending quite a lot of time with this Jean Lucy Pratt. How do you feel about her nowadays?
It's very interesting. I feel that I kind of obviously know her very well.
Do you like her?
I do like her. I mean, thank God. But I liked her from the first, otherwise I wouldn't have done the project. Or I would have just said, look, you know, after 3 or 4 of her journals, I would have said, I really don't like you, or we're not getting on here. And therefore, I think we need to call it a day, as you would with a friend. But for me, it's a sort of lifelong friendship in a way, even though I've only sort of feel that I've known her for 10 or 12 years. And I do like her. And so someone asked me, actually, you know, how would you felt if you'd met her? And I kind of felt, well, I sort of have met her, you know. I mean, that's the glorious thing about the honesty of her journals. You really do feel that she is talking to you from beyond the grave.
Did you ever feel like you would have wanted to give her a piece of advice?
I mean, especially with men. I mean, the classic thing is that, you see, she had 4 big relationships. She wanted to have a husband and kids in a very kind of traditional, classic way, and she didn't in the end. But she had 4 very big relationships in her life. And you see these men sort of coming. She would meet them at a party, and you see them in your mind's eye, you know, in the corner of the room, and they're moving towards her. And Jean thinks, oh, he looks nice, or maybe they meet at work or whatever. And you want to say to her, listen, don't go with this bloke, because I've already read how you described him, you know, on 4 pages further on. And he's not the nicest man. Plus, he's married. Plus, he says he's going to leave his wife, and he doesn't. You know, so all those kind of things. So you want to advise her against it, but of course, she never listens.
She never listens. So I've got to ask you, what about Babs? What does she sort of make of the draft? Was it collaborative at all, or did you just sort of present her and say, here it is?
Her niece was great. She said, look, okay, I'm going to give these to you to edit now, and I'm looking forward to the results, but off you go. And in fact, I mean, she's in her 80s now, and she didn't really have the time or perhaps the energy to really get more involved, but she was so grateful. So I sent her a draft out of courtesy, really, more than anything else, and she was so grateful to have them. And she really said, I mean, she said to me, just thank you so much for sort of fulfilling Jean's wishes, you know, for actually having this book out there and having these edited journals out there. And so she was grateful, which I'm pleased about, because had she come back and said, you know, you haven't mentioned this, or how about that, or you paint me in such a bad light, but she was very, very gracious about it.
So this book, A Notable Woman, The Romantic Journals of Jean Lucy Pratt, is out now, and it is published by Canongate. Thank you, Simon.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Now, we've just been getting to know the life a little better, Marcus, of Jean Lucy Pratt. Now, let's delve into some good music, too. This is new from Virginia's Wild Nothing. This is To Know You.
That was Wild Nothing with To Know You. We'll be getting to know Team Judah and stories from Ukraine after this.
Monocle Films indulges in a spot of Christmas shopping in the idyllic town of Bazzana del Grappa in northern Italy.
In 1992, confectioner Mario Sarri and his wife Sabrina Bonon opened Dolce Bassano to showcase his pastry creations. Together with 8 helpers, Sarri makes all the little delights that are tidily arranged behind a counter. Soft cream-filled meringues are a highlight.
Festive shopping advice on film, now playing in the film section at monocle.com.
Tim Judah is a reporter who's told stories from troubled regions such as Afghanistan, Serbia, Uganda and Armenia. But his regular beat is as a Balkans correspondent for The Economist. It means he spent a lot of time reporting on the turbulent events in Ukraine over the past few years.
He's now collected some of those events into a new book, In Wartime, Stories from Ukraine. But the book isn't simply a picture of the political and military tit-for-tat in region. Judah's book is a collection of very personal vignettes opening windows on brief chapters of people's lives, ranging from mothers to soldiers, businessmen to poets, and, of course, politicians. Monocle's Tom Hall met Tim a little earlier to hear about the human side of a nation in turmoil.
Tim Judah, thanks for joining us here on Monocle 24. We're here to discuss not only your book, but the current situation in Ukraine. But we should start with the book, which is In Wartime, Stories from Ukraine. It very much is a collection of stories as opposed to one sort of united narrative. Perhaps maybe you wanted to create a narrative message towards if people read through the whole thing, but people can dip in and out because I've been really struck by just the human scale of the stories. You have tales of real political and military upheaval, but then you also have these little portraits of, I really loved the story about driving through, is it Bessarabia? Am I saying that right?
Bessarabia, Ukrainian Bessarabia, exactly. Yeah,
Where they stop you with a time at one border and then see how long it takes you to get through the other to check that you haven't stopped in Moldova to perhaps
exactly,
buy your apples.
Yeah, that's a kind of quite a strange place, a strange part of Ukraine. It's a sort of part to the, I don't want to get this wrong, it's part to the west of Odessa. And it's sort of caught between the Black Sea on one side, Romania on the other side, and to the north, Moldova. But from the main part of Ukraine, there's only actually 2 roads in. And one of them, because of Soviet cartography, leads through Moldova. And so when you leave Ukraine, you have to get a little ticket, and then you have to speed through Moldova, and then you merge back into Ukraine again about 15 minutes later. But this is kind of one of these kind of strange, crazy sort of Soviet legacies. And the way that they dealt with it was that the Ukrainians and the Moldovans made a deal, and the Ukrainians are allowed to control the road. So if you step off the road, which you're not allowed to do to buy apples, for example, there are ladies selling apples on the side of the road, then you've done something illegal because you've stepped illegally into Moldova. And but in exchange, the Moldovans were given 450 metres of territory on the Danube, on the other side of Bessarabia, so they could build a port, because the way the Soviets drew the maps, Moldova obviously had no coastline, but it didn't even have access to the Danube. And that way, kind of seagoing ships can sail up the Danube and get to Moldova. So that's what they did.
As shown by that one tiny example, there's so much ethnic diversity and kind of national crossing of even unspecified borders in Ukraine. Do you think that the country was almost destined to fail? And would you call it a failed state at the moment? Or do you think that the Western aligned area of it is still something worth preserving and trying to claw back from the more Russian aligned factions?
No, not at all. I certainly wouldn't call it a failed state. I mean, it's a state which has been badly run, that's for sure, over the last 23 years since independence. But it's certainly not a failed state. But it may well be that Mr. Putin wanted to create a failed state. I'm sure that's what he wanted to do. But in that, he has not succeeded. He managed to prize off Crimea, the peninsula in the south, and rebels backed by his troops managed to take about 5% of Ukrainian territory. But the rest of it remains very much under Ukrainian control and is in dire need of modernization and reform, but is certainly not a failed state.
Coming back to the small portrait again, I'm looking at the Bessarabia story. There's a guy that you talked to in there, and he's trying to define what the makeup of supporters for, say, Russia and Ukraine are in the area. And he kind of changes his opinion a few times. And then eventually at the end, he says they'll support whoever gives them a better life. Do you think that that sort of easily swayed persuasion is something that's creating a lot of tension in the area? And, you know, is it all about whether you feel Russian? Is it about whether you feel Ukrainian? Or is it more about, well, Russia might be able to give us better hospitals, it might be able to give us better roads?
I think that the vast majority of people in Ukraine and feel Ukrainian and wouldn't have that dilemma. Bessarabia is a slightly unusual region because it's got a very mixed population of Bulgarians, Romanians, Moldovans, Gagauz, who are a Turkic-speaking Christian group, and Russians and Ukrainians. So it's a kind of slightly unusual area. Having said that, I mean, it's clear that there are parts of the south and the east where identity is somewhat fluid. Sometimes people can be Ukrainian, sometimes people can feel more Russian, and the south and the east do speak Russian. But the fact is that what's happened is that the Russians and Mr. Putin probably assumed that all Russian speakers wanted to be a part of Russia and would gladly jump at the chance to be part of Russia. And that has clearly not happened in this wartime period. And you know, a large proportion of soldiers who are fighting, Ukrainian soldiers who are fighting the rebels and the Russians are Russian speakers. So I think actually, to a certain extent, what Putin has done is that some people say he won Crimea, but he lost Ukraine, in the sense that he helped consolidate for many people a sense of Ukrainian identity, which is not based on language. Clearly, there are areas which, and there are people who would still regard themselves as sort of as pro-Russian. But I think that political tendency is clearly in abeyance, at least for now. If the reform process in Kiev fails, then all bets are off.
And the book covers, obviously, the last 2 years. I mean, for someone who has not been out there, such as myself, we've heard for the last kind of few months that there's this very kind of fragile and often sort of broken, it seems, ceasefire. What's the situation of the conflict at the moment? Is the ceasefire respected, you know, 90% of the time? And is it even worthwhile having a ceasefire if people don't respect it 10% of the time?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think actually the situation has completely changed in the last few months. First of all, it is worth pointing out that although the ceasefire was ragged, actually since last February, the front lines have not moved at all. What has happened is that a peace process or a kind of disengagement process under the OSCE has begun. So a lot of the fighting has been not with kind of the heavy artillery and tanks that there was before. Having said that, until the beginning of September, people were dying on either side of the line, you know, almost every day, not necessarily every day. And at the beginning of September, the situation completely changed and you had weeks without any fighting and without anyone being killed. And what does that coincide with? It coincides with exactly the point at which Russian soldiers begin to appear in Syria. So it appears at that point the Russians decided to disengage to basically, they don't want to provoke the Ukrainians. They don't want to, they wanted to do something. The Ukrainians had in fact stopped them. And they decided, well, perhaps this is the time to freeze the situation. And the last, I think, in the last couple of weeks, there's been a little bit of an upsurge. But I was, you know, on Twitter this morning, I saw somebody saying that somebody tweeting from the region that and close to the line that I actually had nothing to say because actually nothing had happened. So the situation has actually changed, and it is a ceasefire that more or less is holding. And I think that means that we are clearly heading towards some sort of frozen conflict, and how long that lasts is anybody's guess.
Yeah. I wanted to come to a point that you mentioned there. I've heard from a few experts in recent months that Putin doesn't want a conflict on two fronts. He's now in Syria, and that is one of the reasons for maybe his involvement with Ukraine kind of cooling off. Do you think it's to do with Putin's lack of appetite for stirring more conflict, or do you think it's to do with the people in the area saying no more conflict? What do you think is pushing that the most?
I think that what's happened is that unexpectedly to the Russians, the Ukrainians actually, after a very chaotic start in the wake of the revolution, basically fought back and stopped them. There was no fighting in Crimea. It happened like a week after the revolution. You know, nobody fought back, and it was a much more pro-Russian region. I think that unexpectedly for the Russians, that the Ukrainians managed to organise, to mobilise themselves. Their army was in a very poor shape. The security services were in a very poor shape. But they coupled with basically militia units, stop the Russians. The only way that the Russians and the rebels could have moved forward was if more regular Russian soldiers came to the help of the rebels and died. And I think that Russia decided it wasn't going to do that. I think that this was coincided with the collapse in the price of oil, which is making life difficult for Russia and for supplying its budget, of course. And there were no kind of great victories to be had here. And so the media in Russia and Putin himself have basically stopped talking about it. And now the media is full of its great victories, in inverted commas, fighting in Syria. And I think that the other thing that was effective were Western sanctions on Russia. And I think that part of the game plan was to try and use Syria to try and align itself somehow with Western countries, which has failed to do, in a bid to get sanctions lifted. So I think there are all these elements were in play.
And there's all these contemporary elements, but also the book is somewhat historical in a way, because the stories of sort of yesteryear come through the people you speak to. There's the guy who remembers the Russians coming in 1939 to lecture on collectivization. I mean, do you think that the rest of the world needs to sort of relook at the history and kind of read up maybe on the involvement of Russia with Ukraine to kind of get a sense of the nuances? Or do you think that Russia's recent involvement is coming from a completely contemporary place?
No, I definitely think that to understand the conflict, you need to understand the history. You may not, but what I thought was that when I began this project, you know, I went to bookshops and I looked online, and there wasn't much. I mean, for a very big country with 45 million people, there was very little out there that you could buy. There were some very serious history books to talking about the history of Ukraine from the year dot to today, and there were some very serious political books telling you, and then on December the 22nd this happened, and then on January the 1st this happened, etc., etc. But there was nothing which kind of basically singled out the bits of history which are important today to understanding to the conflict today and to understanding the context of what's happening today. So what I want to do is to sort of take out those elements which are important today and to illustrate those. And I think it is important to understand, you know, a little bit about the history of this country. And one of the key kind of things that one has to understand is that a large part of what is now Ukraine was part of the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, or certainly the west of it, was not part of the Russian Empire. It was part of, first of all, on the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And then, for example, areas like Bessarabia, which we've talked about, were part of Romania after the Second World War, and Lviv and large parts of the west were part of Poland. Lviv was the third biggest city, Polish city, until the Second World War.
And well, Lviv has three names, right? Depending
well,
on
has
who's
more
saying
than Lviv.
It.
Yeah. Lviv, Lvov, Lemberg, yeah. Lemberg. I mean, it has when I'm moving on, but Lviv is particularly interesting as a city because it was a city of Ukrainians, Jews, and Poles. And so Lviv actually has kind of almost three histories, which sometimes quite different. Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews all have a kind of different history and different remembrances of Lviv or Lvov or Lemberg or Lemberg.
And then looking finally towards the future, I don't want you to ask to forecast the exact sort of turnout of how Ukraine is going to end up. But I mean, you've been there, you've been reporting over many years in that region and that part of the world. Where do you see this situation and how do you see it ending?
A lot depends on what happens in Kiev. That's to say, can the this post-Maidan government, which is now all coming up for 2 years old, can this post-Maidan government push through reforms which really make a difference to people's lives? And that's a very difficult thing to do in a short amount of time, because the problem with Ukraine was that for 23 years after independence, it was not reformed. It kept a lot of the Soviet heritage and administration, and it fell prey to a kind of rapacious political elite and oligarchs. So most people in what should by rights be a very rich country didn't feel that their lives had improved much. And if this government cannot modernize Ukraine and make people's lives better quickly, then a lot of people will sort of begin to look back to a sort of more kind of Russia-friendly option. But it's a very difficult thing to do. And let me just give you a very clear example why. Let's look at the judiciary. You have like approximately 9,000 judges in Ukraine. And I don't want to impugn them, every single judge, but the judges and the judicial sector is deemed to be very corrupt. So some people say, well, it'd just be simple. You just fire 9,000 judges and find 9,000 new ones. But the point is that if you employ 9,000 new judges and pay them €200 a month, which is what they're paid now, it's not going to help, because a judge being paid €200 is going to need to feed his family and is going to take bribes. So it's a whole question of reforming the system. And that's not just for judges, it's for like the whole system. And it's a big country.
Yeah.
And needing to do it fast. So it's really a race against time for Ukraine now.
That was Monocle's Tom Hall talking to the reporter Tim Judah. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
When Norwegian journalist and author Lars Mytting penned a book about one of the contemplative pleasures of his life, chopping and stacking wood, he gave it the cheeky and yet perfectly literal title, Norwegian Wood. Whether Haruki Murakami or the Beatles have yet been in touch, we'll soon find out.
But the success of the book has taken everyone by surprise, not least of all Mytting himself, who knew that the simple act of being amongst woodland and using it for essential daily tasks would find such a global audience. His book has topped bestseller lists and has also spawned a Norwegian TV show featuring guests simply explaining their love of firewood and footage of glowing fires too. Lars joined us on the line now to explain this phenomenon. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Lars. So earlier you had already gained quite a lot of attention for your novels. How come you all of a sudden decided to write a book about wood, chopping, stacking and drying wood?
Well, the idea was basically to write a non-fiction book that also gave room for the language and the quality of a novel, actually. And the main character in Norwegian Wood, I would say, is the solitary man who finds pleasure in the simple things in life, but also linking to something much bigger and deeper, namely giving warmth to his own family.
Well, Lars, let me ask you about that, because it's interesting in the book, this notion that you can tell a lot about someone. You mentioned this solitary individual. You can tell a lot about a person by how they treat wood, how they stack it, how they chop it. What sort of interesting nuggets could you find? I know, for example, if someone stacks quite a low pile, that tells you one thing. Did anything surprise you?
Well, that's quite correct, really, that you can judge a man by his wood pile. And a really tall pile would be a sign of ambition, but also perhaps foolhardiness. If you build so high that a small gush of wind will blow it down, then you've told something about your ability to, say, fulfill your vision. On the other hand, if you build a really low stack, you might be very cautious, but still, you know also where your limits are. A really bad sign is, of course, wood that's been lying on the ground and got moldy. That is a sign of bad ability to stick to the plans and follow the intentions.
Lars, the English version of Norwegian Wood is out now, and it's already been a massive success in the Nordic region. That's something that has probably surprised you as well. Why do you think wood has so much appeal? Is it something that in this polarized world people want to go back to the basics?
I think there are two perfectly good answers to it, and one of them is, yes, in a digital world, we really find pleasure in, say, the smaller, simpler things in life, where the result of the work is something that you can touch and see immediately after your labor is invested. That's a quite rare thing, really, in the days where so many of us work in offices or are part of the big machine. On the other hand, firewood is also something that I think is deeply linked in and encoded in all humans, because it's our oldest source of heat, and it's been with us since the dawn of time.
Well, Lars, it strikes me as interesting that manages to transcend cultures. It manages even to transcend urban life. I myself have a very small fire in my house, but I stack a very small amount of logs each winter in readiness. Do you think that this is important because it connects, as you say, back to something more fundamental? And does that make the book maybe about humanity? Is it a social study rather than a book about the natural world, in your view?
Most of all, it's a book about the whole process, really, but also about how humans connect to nature and our connections with the seasons, our place in a world of shifting temperatures. And I think one of the great pleasures in building a fire is essentially the same sense of safety and comfort that that the caveman had in the old days. So I think it really connects us back to something very deeply rooted and essential.
Are there differences when you look at the world and you look at those aspects in the humankind? Do you think there are differences in different countries? For example, I was surprised to find out that Scandinavians, they are not top consumers of wood in the world.
No, that's right. Per capita, the countries, mountainous countries like Bhutan, are actually the biggest consumers. Norway consumes a massive amount, but that is simply because we are many. There are 5 million of us. But per capita, it's often the smaller countries that use it both for heating and for cooking that use the most. And there are a lot of different traditions, and also some good and quite bad things, because in the underdeveloped countries, you see that pollution and the type of heating is also a big source of diseases.
Oh, sorry, no, I was going to ask you about looking across the sort of Scandinavia and the Nordic region, though. And there does seem to be an appreciation for slightly more considered, you know, books that have a gentler pace, maybe. Marcus mentioned in the introduction that we've seen successful television programmes simply of fires being constructed and fires burning. Do you think there's something in the, I don't know, the Nordic sensibility that's a bit more patient, that maybe takes a little time to look at things differently, and maybe everyone in the rest of the Western world could learn a thing or two from that?
There's a small lesson in taking pleasure in something that cannot be rushed. And if you are securing firewood for a full winter, it will be quite a lot of labor. And it also will require you to take the time it takes, both when of the work itself, but also in the seasoning. And watching it season is something that one should consider being a very boring process. But it's actually a process far more revealing of what's happening than, say, when a bottle of wine is maturing. Because it shifts, it smells, and it cracks open. All of this very, very slowly. It will take several months to be ready. But it's something that you can follow and admire. And it won't change day by day, but perhaps week by week. Not many other things in life that you actually have direct use for will mature, yeah?
Lars, you make it all sound very peaceful and zen, but at the same time, I'm wondering, how divisive a topic is wood? I understood that, for example, after that TV show in Norway, you got some feedback about stacking.
Oh yes, it's a quite passionate subject, really, because there are individual variations, and there are also geographical variations on what is considered the right way of doing it. And one of the biggest discussions in Norway is if we should stack with the bark up or with the bark down. And I think that there's nothing that has damaged more parties in Norway than this particular discussion.
By the way, Lars, being Finnish, I'm aware of the Finnish version of this book, and I know that you made a slightly altered version for the Finnish market. You added some information on saunas and heating saunas. Have you done the same tricks with other markets? For example, for the UK, is there anything about how to use wood to heat a nice cup of tea?
Well, it's tailored somehow, yes. And one of the great things that has, I think, one of the things where Scandinavia and the UK really differs is that our tradition has never been broken by cold. And for the UK and the US edition, I also made a bit more on tailoring, on how to use a wood stove and also how to avoid pollution in the best way. So especially the chapters on the small tricks on how to burn it with as little smoke as possible, that has been tailored a bit for the UK and US audience.
Lars, I wanted to ask you about some of your favourites, because there's some wonderful photographs in the UK edition and I believe in the original, with some winners. For example, the ARC National Firewood Stacking Competition winner is one I'm looking at now, which is Inge Hardem. Do you have a favourite? This is the full height stack masterclass Sunwall woodpile. Is that high on your list? Do you have a personal favourite technique?
Well, I really like when they say surround the whole house, all four walls, with firewood. That makes a really majestic impression. But my own favorite is the round stack, the beehive stack, which it looks completely symmetric from the outside. But in the middle there is room for all the twisted logs and the roots and all the odd ones that doesn't fit in. So I think that's both functional and very, very beautiful.
Lars, just finally, when you conducted research for this book, did anything change about the way you consume wood nowadays?
I use even more, actually. For me, it's become a goal of having firewood that I've collected as near the house as possible, and also to burn it as cleanly as possible. So I've been obsessed by using modern clean burn technology and get ready very early so that I have enough for at least two winters. So my own awakening as a firewood nerd has also grown a lot during the writing of this book, and it never ends, really. I still get a lot of letters from all around the world with people describing what they do, and I always pick up and learn new tricks.
The book is a delight, and it'll warm the cockles of many a heart, I'm sure, this festive season and beyond. It's Norwegian Wood, Chopping, Stacking and Drying Wood, the Scandinavian Way. The author is Lars Mytting. Lars, it's a great pleasure speaking to you. Thanks very much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Well, Marcus, another one bites the dust. What a show that was.
Yeah, did you like that Lucy Brad book as much as I
very
thought
much,
you would?
Very much. I think, and I thought it was interesting to hear how beautifully Simon talked about it. You know, it's such a personal account.
Have you ever written diaries,
experience,
by the way? Because I tried every now and then I thought that, shit, if someone discovers them, I just don't want anyone to know that much about me.
Those would sell like hotcakes, wouldn't they? They're hippie journals.
No, my revelation book is going to come out a bit later, so you are going to be involved in it, included.
What happened to you, the early hippie journals? Were they destroyed by fire or something? I can imagine,
I think they're somewhere behind locks.
Oh, they still exist?
They still exist. They are somewhere. They are somewhere, but you will never get to see them
back home in Silignore.
On another hand, after that Mytting interview on Nordic wood, do you think you will be dealing with wood differently? I know you've got a fireplace, don't you, at home?
I do, and actually, I have a log box. You know that Lars was talking about this, some sort of primal thing about building a fire. It connects us back into some very profound old experience.
It doesn't do that for me.
Oh, it definitely does. The construction of the fire itself, I find maybe more compelling than stacking the wood up.
Okay, then.
Marcus, I think we should thank the team behind Edition 336 of the Monocle Weekly. The show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. Thanks to them both.
Andrew Tuck and Robert Bout will be back for the Monocle Weekly next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Marcus Hippi.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.